Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Judiciary Committee. We have a packed house, as you can see. We had another room that's actually being used for carryover. So we are going to probably need to be limiting testimony on the various bills that we have before us. Right now, I'm going to go ahead and open up an informational hearing. Since I only have two members, we need to have a third to have a quorum. This informational hearing is going to be open on Senate Bill 774. The purpose for opening up this informational hearing is to take Senator Byers' testimony because he has other duties that he needs to accomplish. In fact, at this point, we're opening up a public hearing on 774. Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, I'm Lee Byer. I am the state senator representing Central Linn and Lane counties. Haven't expanded that far yet to Lincoln. Senator, you know, this is a very small bill, and I don't think these people behind me will have any interest in it. But and
I think no one in this has anything
to do with carrying a gun. Senator, this is a bill that I have to apologize for bringing to you in this form. It came out of LC, as we often say, a little different than what we went into. It's sort of like using a sledgehammer to do finished carpentry work. But let me tell you the problem that I was trying to address here and tell you what this is about. This is about traditional CC&Rs or conditions that are placed on real estate that limit its future use. And I'm very supportive of those, and they have a useful purpose, but this particular issue that I was trying to deal with has to do with when a CC&R that was placed in years ago comes into conflict with public policy in our zoning laws. And the best way to describe it is to tell you the situation that I became aware of. There is a corner in Springfield that has existed in semi-development for, you know, since the 1930s. It was originally developed outside the city, and this particular corner was farmland and residential, and the owner of the property in the early 40s put a restriction on the property that said this land can only be used for single-family residential into the future. Bring that forward to today. And that corner now has a Fred Meyer on one side of it, a gas station on another, and then three strings of very small, very run-down single-family homes that are currently sitting on land that is zoned for commercial development, but they have single-family residences. And the situation it places the property owner in, of one of these houses, is that they really can't sell the land because of the CC&R that's on it says that it can only be used for single family. And in fact, if the house were to burn down today, the city under their zoning code could not allow them to rebuild the house, so it would be vacant land. The real question that I was trying to get at is this is obviously a conflict with the existing policy, and it's not like a traditional CCR where you're saying, you know, the condominium authority doesn't want you to change the paint on the color of your unit versus the others, or the requirement that you have brick on a 30-year house, that kind of thing. This is where it's really in conflict with the zoning, and that's what I was trying to change. As I understand it, working with some people around it, they've tried to get at it, but their avenues to get at it would be they'd have to go back to get the people who put the original condition on the property and change it, get their agreement to change it, or surrounding property owners, and frankly, that's not happening. A number of real estate people have looked at it, and one of the owners across the street says, well, I'll sign off on it, but it'll cost you a couple $100,000. Well, realistically, what that means is in this condition, you have something that's not in compliance with the zoning that the community has set for the property, and you can't change it. Financially, it doesn't make sense to do anything with the lot that way. I think that's inconsistent with public policy, and I think there ought to be a way to fix that. My original idea was to say in the situations like that, the property owner ought to be able to go to the city council in this case and say, this is the situation, it's inconsistent with your policy, will you petition the court to change it, to bring it in conformance with the land use of the policy, and the court would have the option, after allowing all the legal avenues, to say, yes, that is consistent with public policy. That's what I was trying to do. This one goes, the bill is drafted, goes a little bit farther than that, and I think it's raised a concern, legitimate concerns of a lot of folks in the real estate community, those who live in condominiums. So, Mr. Chair, that was my intent, and the reason I had it sent here is because you're the legal smart people, and I hope that you could find a solution to the problem.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have an excellent way to do this. We call those work groups. And so I'm wondering if you'd like to be a participant in that work group.
I would if there are people who would like to do that.
All right, so what we're going to do, we're not going to be working the bill today. What we will be doing is taking additional testimony in order, and then we'll find out from there, working through council, as to setting up a small work group to see if we can come have a meeting of the minds to attempt to address your issues and at the same time address theirs. Any questions for Senator Beyer? Not seeing any, I'm going to go ahead and recess the hearing on Senate Bill 774. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
What we're going to do, folks, is we're going to start at the top of the agenda. We're going to be working through this. As you can see, as I mentioned at the very beginning, we have a number of people that want to give testimony on various bills. So what we're going to do, if, as need be, we'll be limiting testimony so we can try to get everyone heard today, so we will not have to carry bills over and people will not have to come back on Monday. With that, I'm opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 346.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 346 exempts audio recording of 911 callers' voice from disclosure under public records law unless public interest requires, permits unrestricted disclosure of transcript, creates exceptions for law enforcement, criminal defense, and training purposes.
All right, thank you. I have a panel that's of Laura Wolf, Amanda Fritz, and Dan Eisenbeis. Last thing I'm going to ask, if you have written testimony, please do not read that into the record. We will read it for ourselves. What we need you to do is summarize or highlight your highlights so we can stay on time. Thank you very much. Well, we'll see.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Daniel Eisenbeis with the City of Portland. Here with me today are Commissioner Amanda Fritz and Laura Wolf of the Bureau of Emergency Communications. The two of them will cover our substantive testimony, but all three of us are available to address any questions you may have. And I should note for the record that we've had some recent conversations with parties about some minor technical amendments to the bill that we'll be planning to work on.
All right. Yeah, we're not planning on doing work session on this bill. I understand we'll take the testimony and we'll give you an opportunity to work out the finer points. Commissioners.
Good morning, Senator Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Laura Wolf. I'm with the City of Portland 911 Center, and I'm here today asking your support of Senate Bill 346. Essentially what this change does is changes the way the law covers the public release of audio recordings with 911 centers. The way it works today, if it's in the best interest or there's no harm being done by the release of a 911 audio tape, we have to release it under records law. And a lot of times those go out to the media and victims hear it on the phone or on the media and so forth. What this change does is requires the calling party to give consent before the tape is released. There's some instances there where it can be overridden if it's in the best interest of the request that we would have to release the tape, but at the point now it's where the victim or the calling party or an adult person would have to give consent before we release the call to the general public or to the media. I provide a written testimony about this and how it outlines, so I'll just keep it there and leave it for any questions you might have about
Thank
that.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. I'm City Commissioner Amanda Fritz. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 346, and thank you to Senator Rosenbaum for introducing the bill. This issue came to my attention when a constituent told me about her family experience of an extremely traumatic event, sharing the agony caused by hearing her voice on public broadcasts without concern for the callers. She asked for my help as Commissioner in charge of Multnomah County's 911 Center. Let me say clearly that I welcome full public scrutiny of government workers' responses to 911 that will still be easily available under this bill. This bill provides protection for vulnerable callers. The most recent example of inappropriate media coverage of a 911 call was just earlier this month, with a call from a person who broke into a home, was taking a shower, and called 911 because the homeowner returned and he was afraid the homeowner might harm him. even though transcripts show that the homeowner, who also called 911, stated, "He's obviously nuts." Apparently, Good Morning America, numerous local news stations, and the Oregonian thought that broadcasting the tape of the call and ridiculing a man who likely has serious mental illnesses was in the public interest. I'm a retired registered nurse. I worked in psychiatry for 26 years. I believe that's wrong. People experiencing mental illnesses should be able to call 911 and expect the same HIPAA privacy protections as when they call inpatient psychiatry at OHSU. That is, they should consent to the release of their personal information. 911 calls often involve callers asking callers for sensitive medical information and drug and alcohol history. I believe callers should decide whether to broadcast the call made on possibly the worst day of their lives, not journalists looking for titillating stories. What is the public purpose in everyone listening to the 911 call last year in Bend when a wife shot her husband thinking he was an intruder? Wouldn't hearing this call potentially bias the jury or cause harm to the family's reputation if it's then widely discussed in coffee shops and PTA meetings? Even though the transcripts of the calls would still be available, the sensationalism of the story is diminished without the tapes of callers' voices. I respect your request not to read my testimony. However, you know from your experience that hearing voices and seeing faces is very different from reading a letter or an email. Voices can convey anguish and pain in a word the written word can't. I expect you will hear today from parties who will argue that individual media outlets should have the ability to decide which 911 calls they broadcast. This misses the point. Given the personal nature of each call, I believe it only makes sense that privacy protections are extended to the records because most callers believe when calling 911 that their calls are confidential. The journalist's ethics guidelines for deciding whether or not to air 911 calls are a series of questions, not mandates or standards.
Commissioner, I hate to do this, but I need you to please wrap up.
Okay, thank you. I do believe that this strikes a balanced approach that does allow, and this is not in my written testimony, it's the latest version of it. I want you to know that we do monitor our 911 calls ourselves. Every critical incident, the handling of the call is reviewed, and 4 to 10 calls are reviewed by supervisors every month in an ongoing professional quality assurance mechanism. So this isn't about not having 911 operators' voices called. If the caller feels the call has been mishandled, they will surely give permission for it to be broadcast. Thank you very much for your consideration.
All right, thank you very much for your abbreviated testimony.
Quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome. Thank you for your testimony. I just want to clarify for the record that the transcript would still be available at any time without consent. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 6, lines 22 and 23 of the bill, it allows the labor organizations to obtain a video recording of the voice caller. Can you explain why that is? Why that's included in the bill?
That is in there to assure that an employee, if they are subject to a disciplinary proceeding, has access to recordings that that may help defend their case.
Because again, sometimes the intonation may make a difference in that the transcript might not. So this is when we do our reviews that the labor union, who would be helping to defend the grievance perhaps, would have access to the audio tape.
Would that not be available through discovery anyway?
There may be administrative proceedings that don't involve discovery and subpoena. And if the employer is not using the recording as part of their case for the disciplinary proceeding, then it would not be subject to discovery, is my understanding.
Thank you.
And we wanted to make it as clear as possible that this isn't about restricting access to performance on 911 callers. It's about privacy for the caller.
Thank you all very much for coming forward today. We have a Marianne Schreib who would like to give testimony today. If you'll come forward, I'm also going to ask Dave Fiscom and Andrea Meyer to join her at the podium.
We're going to hear it short, Senator.
Right.
We've got two people written down.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did not see that. Okay. Marion, if you'd be so kind, we'll take your testimony. Andrea, you can come on up, and then we'll bring the other two up.
Well, I beg your indulgence. I can't just... I've worked on my presentation. I'd like to read it, or else I would not and just turn it into you. But
okay. Do you have written testimony here?
I do.
Okay. We would prefer the written testimony, so that would be part of the record.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to summarize, we'll be more than glad to listen, but we... Because due to the number of bills we have and witnesses, I'm not going to be able to let you read each piece word for word. We can go through the written material ourselves.
Okay. 2 points. Senator Brzozowski, Chair Krause, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marianne Schwab. I'm a retired high school secretary. As someone who has experienced personal tragedy in this regard, every time I hear a traumatic 911 call broadcast in the media, I feel deep sympathy for the families of the individuals involved, in part because of my own personal grief. That's including your 911 responders. They relive the same incident. And I'm asking you to please support this because it allows for the recordings to be released without the consent of the caller if in any particular instance the public interest in disclosure outweighs the caller's right to privacy. I think we've got the yin and the yang in this really tight. Multnomah County does a fantastic job. What this was meant to be was a housekeeping so that all 136 statewide call centers followed those principles and those guidelines. They're very well set. And I do appreciate all the hard work that has been done by our district attorney, Michael Schrunk, Lisa Nato, Steve March, and Diane Rosenbaum has been at this since 2001, trying to get this in. And I'm very frustrated with the power that we continue to give the lobbyist over the individual citizen. And I'd like to think that I'm here today for that's one Oregonian. We are as strong as our weakest unit. That's a family. We need to support those families in their time of trauma and give them every respect and dignity. When something is seriously wrong, they do have the time. The investigators need time, both fire and police, to review these things. The media can read the text. You don't like having it read. I don't like reading it either. Thank you.
Ms. Schwab,
please support the bill.
Stay there for just a second. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for coming down and sharing your experiences. I know it cannot be easy for you to be here. We really honor your testimony today. Is there any questions for her? Thank you again for coming forward today.
Okay, I'd like to have Dave Fiscom, Bill, is it Johnstone, if I've got that right, and Andrea Meyer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Dave Fiscom here representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, which consists of more than 200 radio and television stations around the state. With me to my left is Bill Johnstone, the president and CEO of the association. We are here this morning to oppose Senate Bill 346 because it bars media access to 911 tapes, and that is a position our association has taken for several sessions now. Before this hearing, we did the due diligence of meeting with the bill's prime sponsor, Senator Rosenbaum, as well as with City of Portland Commissioner Amanda Fritz and Dan Eisenbeis to discuss the bill with them in person and to convey the reasons for our opposition. Allow me just to make a brief comment before turning, Mr. Chair, with your permission, to Mr. Johnstone. And we have submitted for the record a number of pieces of information for your review. Our basic proposition is that managers of Oregon broadcast outlets are well able to police themselves when it comes to the use of 911 tapes. We weigh very carefully the journalistic decisions about tapes, just as we do about other coverage of the public's business. And we believe the decision about striking the proper balance, and there is a proper balance, between the public's right to know and personal privacy rests best with the news media, not with government. So, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'll turn to Mr. Johnstone, who can amplify on these remarks. Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Johnstone. I am the president and CEO of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and Dave has pretty well covered everything I was going to tell you. So my testimony will be very short. We do feel that we do have the ability to police our own members, and have been doing a very, very good job of that over the very many years that the Oregon Association of Broadcasters has been involved. We do send out, as you have in front of you, both the guidelines and the criteria from the news directors. They just changed their name here. Hang on just a second. The Radio Television Digital News Association, and this is the guidelines that are set out by them, accepted across the country, and we do send those out at least a couple of times a year to remind the news directors and the general managers of the very sensitive issue involved in 911 calls. So we are very, very sensitive to that. Also, the Poynter Institute takes up and is a part of the writing of these guidelines. And the Poynter Institute is a national journalistic ethics project that's the whole job, is to worry about, think about, and try to correct any issues as far as ethics are concerned in broadcast journalism. So they are very well vetted. Banning the 911 tapes, I think, runs counter to Oregon's commitment to improving transparency, and the state set up their own transparency website. And to ban the use of 911 tapes on broadcast and in media, period, I feel would run counter and opposite direction of this transparency that we're trying to move toward. And finally, as a watchdog for the public interest, journalists need to be able to access the original recordings of the 911, not just the written transcripts of the audio. The tone, as mentioned earlier in earlier testimony, I believe from Commissioner Fritz, both the tone and the pace, the tenor of the call is very important in determining the whole feeling of what went into that 911 call. So with that, we would encourage you, please, to oppose this bill, support our position that the broadcasters do know what they're doing and have been doing it for many, many, many years. And we would be ready for your questions whenever you can. Thank you.
Thank you. Andrea.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here in opposition to Senate Bill 346. As this committee well knows, the ACLU often appears to address continued limitations to our public record. I'm just pleased today to not be alone before the committee on this matter, as I have been in the past. It is certainly often the issue that the request for changing the public record has to do with very personal information. Interaction with the public, with the government, does raise for any individual, whatever it might be, whether it's tax information or phone calls or other information that is disclosed in the public record, is often of the personal nature, and it is often that basis for which the exception is sought. But we join in the opposition to limiting, again, our public record. I think the comments just made, we would certainly echo. I, too, is going to note that, as I believe Commissioner Fritz said, the intonation may make a difference when the transcript does not, is precisely the reason that this is not simply a switch out for the transcript. It is a significant difference. I would note, and to be clear, we're not in this situation in a place where we can tinker with or fix the bill. I would note one area that seems to raise concerns as to how it would actually be administered, and that specifically the provision about how if the individual, first of all, giving the authority to the individual caller to consent, and if the individual caller is not available, it gives the consent to a parent, the spouse, a guardian, or another legally recognized representative. I don't know who gets to make that decision. There may be competing interests. I wouldn't know who one would be asking of that authority, how that authority would be expressed, and what happens when different members of a family might disagree. So I think that language creates significant problems, but ultimately we would hope you would not move forward with this proposal, as was not in the past sessions when we've testified. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for this panel? thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
And that concludes the individuals that signed up on Senate Bill 346. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 346? Not seeing anyone coming forward. We'll close that public hearing. We're now going to open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 405. I am going to give notice to those who are here on the work sessions alone. Senate Bill 347, Senate Bill 385, and 387. Right now, it looks like 387 cannot be worked because it's not ready. 347 and 385, I don't think we're going to get to it. If we do have time at the end of the hearing, we will work those bills, but be aware that we may have to carry those over to another day. So with that, Council, if you can give us the opening on Senate Bill 405.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 405 allows the State Board of Higher Education, the Board, to authorize university under its control to establish a police department and employ police officers, permits such department and officers to enforce boards or universities' administrative rules and policies in addition to criminal laws, permits the board to make agreement or authorize university to make agreement with other entities for mutual aid, declares emergency, is effective on passage.
All right, thank you. So, Doug Tripp, if you'll come up as a proponent, and I believe you want it, James, is it Dean? I'm just trying to read the writing. And if you have one, a third person, I'd like to go ahead and fill the panel. So I don't know if that would be Paul or not. Again, gentlemen, if you have written testimony, please do not read it. We'll go through that. If you'll summarize, that would be great. Whoever's going to start.
I will. Thank you, Chair Pozanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is James Bean. I'm Senior Vice President and Provost of the University of Oregon. We're here to support this bill because the University of Oregon is a substantial community, a city within the city about the size of Grants Pass, that has a culture that is somewhat different than surrounding areas. It is also true that our long time and successful partnership with the Eugene Police Department is strained by budget cuts everywhere that does not allow them, the staff, to sometimes respond to issues that we have around the campus. So the ability to have a professional police department on the campus will expand the police services within the greater Eugene and University of Oregon community. A couple of statistics that I will highlight from my testimony are that 98% of universities, public universities of our size in the United States, have their own police departments. 32 of the 33 public members of the Association of American Universities have their own police department, with the University of Oregon being the only exception. 8 of the 10 universities within the Pac-10 have their own police departments. The only exceptions are the University of Oregon and Oregon State University. We support this bill because the growth of the campus and the community and the needs for policing require it for the safety of our students, faculty, and staff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Doug Tripp, and I am the Executive Director of Public Safety at the University of Oregon. I have worked in campus law enforcement since 1989, serving as a director and chief both in the state of Colorado and the state of Wisconsin. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 405. The University of Oregon maintains a highly competent and professional public safety department. We have introduced a deliberate and strategic strategy to improve campus safety at the University of Oregon, and we have aligned with best practices on the national landscape. We've invested significant resources in repositioning the Department of Public Safety to meet the evolving needs of our campus community. We have also embraced a community-oriented and trust-based policing model, something that is unique and necessary within the campus environment. The Department of Public Safety at the University of Oregon employs 90 full-time, part-time, and student workers. We have 5 divisions, 2 teams, and 13 specialized units, and operate under a budget of $5.4 million. 35 of our employees are assigned to the patrol division that provide 24/7 public safety services to the community. These officers operate under ORS 352-385, which allows them to stop and frisk and make probable cause arrest. They also have municipal citation authority under Eugene Code 4.035, which is unique to the University of Oregon. which allows them to issue citations under the municipal code for violations and misdemeanor offenses. All of our officers go through the Lane County Sheriff's Office Reserve Police Academy, which is about 300 hours of training. The reason that we have to go through the Reserve Academy is by statute, we currently are not allowed to participate in the DPSST Basic Police Academy. Our officers are supported by a large cadre of communications, law enforcement records, and criminal intelligence support staff. It's important to note that we also provide, under a shared services agreement, dispatch services to Lane Community College. Our officers provide, again, 24/7 emergency response, critical incident response, and calls for service response to the community. We are the primary law enforcement agency on our campus. We work closely with the Eugene City Police Department for those types of incidents that we cannot handle due to our limited authority and or our training. Unique to the campus environment are the skill sets that our officers require in terms of emergency medical training, fire response training, and basic security services in addition to law enforcement services. Despite all of our limitations under ORS 352-385, our officers essentially conduct themselves like campus police officers. Throughout the nation, as the provost mentioned, 98% of institutions of our size or larger maintain their own police departments. And it's important to clarify that that is not contracted police departments, that's their own unique police departments. And our officers are often mistaken for that. Parents, students, visitors to campus readily assume that the University of Oregon maintains a police department. We all know that that is not true. Our officers are not police officers, and they're limited in what they can do. Until 2009, the state of Oregon did not permit universities to maintain their own police departments. However, during that same time, we witnessed public entities such as county service districts, mass transit districts, and school districts who were permitted under statute to maintain their own police departments. Whether they chose to do that or not, they were provided that under statute. In 2009, Senate Bill 658 was passed, allowing the Oregon Health and Sciences University to create their own police department and hire their own state-certified police officers. OHSU is currently transitioning its non-sworn campus safety department to a sworn agency. Clearly, since 1987, when ORS 352-385 was enacted, college campuses have changed. There's no question about that. The types of interactions that our officers face on a daily basis are truly the types of engagements that regular police officers face. Our officers are not trained as police officers, they're not equipped as police officers, and they certainly don't have the statutory authority of police officers. There are some very unique components, though, to campus policing that we need to recognize. It's difficult to place a municipal or other agency into a campus environment due to the skill sets required by campus police officers. Campus police agencies on the national land front, forefront have been delivering very tailored, culturally competent, community-oriented policing services to their campus constituents. They are experts in engaging diverse and transitory communities in problem-solving and partnership building. Campus police agencies also support the educational mission through their outreach and prevention programming. They also take a community caretaking role. As we often are aware, sometimes our students partake in things a little bit too much on Fridays and Saturday nights. At that time, the people they look to take care of them are our public safety officers. Yet by statute, they're not able to take a community caretaking role. So we depend on external agencies that are pressed for time, moving quickly on weekends, and make decisions that may not be consistent with our expectations.
Chief, I need you to wrap up, please.
Absolutely. I think it's important through all of that to recognize that campus police agencies are part and parcel, part of the campus community. They're accountable to the campus community, and they reflect the values of the campus community. University police, ultimately, though, are always police. They retain the capacity to effectively respond to situations in an appropriate manner to ensure the safety of those they engage and the safety of the community. They are police, first and foremost. The future of campus policing falls on your shoulders. We ask that you consider Senate Bill 405, to assist us in protecting our campuses and to also move away from an archaic system that currently exists under ORS 352-385. We ask that you help keep campuses safe in the state of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul? Good morning, Senator Pruszynski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Paul Shong, and I serve as the Assistant Vice President and Dean of Students at the University of Oregon. I'm pleased to offer comments in support of Senate Bill 405, which will enable the University of Oregon's Department of Public Safety to transition over time to a sworn police agency. We believe that Senate Bill 405 will assist us in our mission to support students in their academic and personal development, creating an agency that will better serve students and ensure safety on the campus of the University of Oregon. The university seeks to join the 98% of other universities our size, the other universities in the Pac-12, and the 32 other public universities affiliated with the Association of American Universities, because we believe this will deliver the best possible services to our students. Senate Bill 405 will allow improved investigation of crimes on campus, improved response to student complaints, and a culturally aligned force well-suited to the culture of our university. As the Dean of Students, I ask for your support of Senate Bill 405. Thank you for your consideration.
Paul, thank you very much. Question, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I wonder, this is not a new issue. We've heard it before and heard a lot of discussion about it. Is there a cost savings from a contract that you have with the Eugene Police Department? Do you have a contract with the Eugene Police?
No, the University of Oregon does not maintain a police contract with the City of Eugene. That contract terminated in 2009, I believe.
Thank you. And can I ask a follow-up, please, yes. Mr. Chair? Your comments were all about the University of Oregon. Does this bill apply to, for example, Oregon State or other entities in the state?
Yes, the bill applies to all public institutions under the governance of the Oregon University system.
Thank you. One more follow-up?
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we heard this issue in 2007, the chancellor had a position in opposition. Do you know if the chancellor has a position on this bill?
The State Board of Higher Education in March of 10 approved the legislative concept, and I believe Ryan Hageman from the system is here to provide testimony.
Thank you so much.
Senator Wessett. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 16, lines 25 to 28, it paraphrases, it says, the fines for arrest or complaints will be distributed as a monetary obligation payable to the university. Is this contemplated to be a source of revenue for the university police force? And where do those fines where do those fines now accrue to? Do they now go to the city of Eugene, or they go to the county of Lane, or what?
Well, currently the citations that our officers issue are under the Eugene Code. We do not realize any revenue stream from the issuance of those citations. We currently are not permitted to issue citations under the state code under our current authority.
Yeah, and let me follow up on that. Senator Wissett, there are two streams of money that comes off a citation. One goes to the court that it's filed with, and the other normally tracks to the department that issues it. Mm-hmm. My understanding is what will happen here, by it becoming, if it becomes a standalone police agency, they would fall in that same formula. And I would assume that the money, I think one of the questions that the senator had was, I assume the money would go into, lack of better terms, the general fund of the university. It would not go specifically back to the department, the police department itself.
Well, through the way we budget model, there would likely be an index that would be created that would receive that revenue, and that index would come under the authority of the Department of Public Safety. We have other mechanisms like that in the department as well.
So the fines would accrue to the agency issuing the fines?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Our next panel is going to be Kevin Campbell, Alex Gardner, and Pete Kearns.
Good Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. We want to thank the university. We had an opportunity to have a lengthy discussion with them about Senate Bill 405. We're here today to support the bill. We assigned or asked three of our police chiefs around the state to participate in this discussion for our association. They included Chief Terry Holderness from Ashland, Chief Ed Boyd from Albany, and Chief Pete Kearns, who's with me today from the city of Eugene, who is probably most impacted or has the most, will have the closest association with one of these university police departments. I have very brief comments, but I wanted to mention a couple components of the bill that were very important to us as an association. First, we believe that any additional police officer that we create in the state should satisfy all of the basic training and ongoing maintenance training standards for any other police department or police officer in the state. We believe that this bill accomplishes that. Two, we believe that police supervision also, a police supervisor should also meet the management and executive certification requirements of the state so that police officers are supervised by a police supervisor. We feel like that's very important. I also believe that's accomplished in the statute. The third component that's very important and has been an issue over the last couple of years is that we believe a police officer should be fully equipped as a police officer, so that regardless of where you are in the state, when you come into contact with a police officer, you're dealing with an individual who has the training and the equipment and the full tools that should be at the disposal of any police department. The reason that's important, and I don't want to divert too much from the testimony today, but as you know, the Oregon Health Sciences University has a police department that was authorized last session. Those police officers do not carry a firearm. And that has created significant issues, in particular for the Portland Police Bureau, that now is in a position to respond to crisis up at OHSU because their own officers are sometimes put at risk, not able to fully respond to a situation, and Portland police have to come in later to help handle it. By the time they come in, as you can imagine, the situation is sometimes at a more dangerous level. And so we were thankful that in discussing this with the university, they understood the importance of this provision, and we do see it in the bill, and we appreciate that. One additional comment related to an amendment that I think will be before the committee, and that is for the purposes of creating a citizen review for university police, which as an association we understand the need for based on the university system, and we just wanted to create one additional point on the record, and that is that we don't support the addition or requirement of citizen review for cities and counties where we believe already city councils and county commissions have the authority and the ability to create these, and they do when it's appropriate for their own communities. And so that would be my only caveat, and then I have no further testimony on that. I appreciate the committee's time. Thank you.
All right. So, Pete, why don't you go next?
Okay.
I always let the prosecutors go last.
I appreciate that. Good morning, Senator Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Pete Kearns. I'm the police chief in Eugene. And I've been working with the Eugene Police Department since 1983, and, in fact, at one time managed the contract that the police department had with the University of Oregon. I support, the City of Eugene supports this bill for many of the same reasons that the university already represented. I value the importance of having a police department that reflects the values of the community that it polices, and I know that with a police force on campus that has policies uniquely designed for their values, and police officers and managers hired specifically for the purpose of providing policing on campus will be a better arrangement than the one that we had previously where the Eugene Police Department for decades provided that service. I should tell you that the City of Eugene, for communities our size and larger in the United States, is in the 85th percentile for property crime. There's only 15% of communities of 100,000 or larger that have a higher property crime rate than we do. The most stubborn property crime problem in Eugene is in the neighborhoods around the University of Oregon. The offenders that are committing those crimes there just feet from the university's campus are walking hither and yon across the university. The same dangerous offenders that walk around the City of Eugene are walking across the campus and being encountered by students and staff and security personnel that work there. And it's important that the that there is a workforce on campus properly trained and equipped to provide policing services, given that there are dangerous offenders there and there is the probability that someday the university will experience an active shooter. When that happens, the ideal response is one where a police officer encounters the offender as quickly as possible. Our current arrangement doesn't ensure that. A responding Eugene police officer would need guidance to the scene of an active shooter from a Department of Public Safety officer, and that would delay response. And we know from studying these incidents across the country that with every passing second, people die. An immediate response saves lives. And so for all these reasons, we're supportive of it. I'll also tell you that the continuity of policing services from the time that a police officer on campus receives and responds to a call and provide and conducts an investigation, that investigation, when carried directly from that officer to prosecution, is a far better product than the one that goes from a Department of Public Safety officer to a Eugene police detective to the district attorney's office or the Eugene Municipal Court. Thank you.
Thank you. Alex?
Good morning, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. My name is Alex Gardner, and I'm the Lane County District Attorney. There's so many things to talk about this morning. I had a little difficulty sort of narrowing it down, but what I'd like to start with is pointing out that Eugene is not Mayberry anymore. Circumstances have changed substantially. For context, we had 8 officer-involved shootings in the 13 months following Senate Bill 111. We have most or all of the threats that large metro areas are encountering on a regular basis. We need to have first responders to high-threat situations be as well-trained and as well-equipped as possible. One of the concerns for me is that the campus security folks don't have any way of excluding people who have, for example, concealed firearms or tasers, but they can't carry either themselves. So they're in a situation where they're responding to conflicts and they have some significant chance of being at a significant disadvantage with respect to the person they're encountering. It's from the standpoint of a prosecutor, the ideal solution is to have the best trained person responding. And Chief Kearns spoke to the importance value of continuity of service. From my perspective, if in a perfect world, if I had a rape reported, I would have a detective able to respond immediately because that's the person who has the tenure and experience and training necessary to do the best possible interview and get the best possible evidence capture at the moment. The least ideal situation is one in which we have poorly trained, by comparison, I don't mean to depreciate the value of the people on campus, but by comparison they are poorly trained because they don't have access to DPSST. And in any event, we want to have the best people responding to get the most information. What we find now is that we have DPS folks respond initially, and then if there is something that is significant, something that's likely to mature into a felony prosecution, we have EPD follow-up typically with patrol and then detectives, and we have too many layers, and it depreciates the process. The only other thing that I'd mention is that the only concern that I've heard from the community is one of whether it's prudent to have a police presence at all on the campus. I mean, that's the complaint from the student body. Obviously, we have to be able to have a police response when we have crimes committed on the campus. There's value in having the response tailored to the local community, and as Chief Kern suggested, having people that are familiar with the environment, who know the leadership on campus, and are able to respond and tailor their response to the community is very valuable.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Senator Vaughn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It isn't really a question. I know we're not in a work session, but I just wanted to make a comment because of what District Attorney Gardner said. I serve on the Senate Education Committee, and we heard a bill dealing with higher education reform. This concept was within that bill, and the students submitted petitions against the bill in large part based on that. And I certainly appreciate all the comments that you've made. I think that there's a pretty big the public relations task that needs to be communicated with the students to let them know that there will be police on campus no matter what. It's just whether where they come from and whether they're specifically trained to the campus is an issue. So I just wanted to bring that up because of hearing their concerns in another committee. And also, Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear from some of the I don't know if they're here today, but I'd like to hear from, for example, Portland State and Oregon State and the other large campuses about how it's impacted them, because I have heard concerns, for example, in Portland because of the campus buildings, that heard concerns about how they may call the Portland police, but they don't know where all the dorms are or all the entrances, and they just don't know the campus as well as they know the city. So I'd like to hear some of those, some of that testimony as well, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Pete, did you have any?
Yeah, Senator, if I could just add one thing. I've also heard the concern about having armed police officers on campus, and I can tell you that the University of Oregon campus will be a safer place when it has its own police force, for the reasons already stated, how it would be uniquely administered and staffed by people hired specifically for that purpose. It's also important to know that Oregon has fewer police per capita than any other state in the country. And Eugene has fewer police than most of Oregon. We're below the state average, which probably would explain why we have such a high property crime rate. Adding 26 well-trained, well-managed police officers to the inventory of staff that we have there would be helpful to the students and staff that live and work at the University of Oregon.
All right, thank you. What I'm going to do is put a couple things on the record. Kevin Campbell brought up the point about having review boards as to being appropriate for university settings. This is one of the things, as the chair, I required to be put in the bill, because I think it's important for that community to have the ability to have this input. This, from my perspective, will in fact allow the faculty, the students, and the communities at large to have an opportunity. Where in the cities or counties, they have local government, they have elected officials, and I know that the City of Eugene, which I actually served on the police commission for 6 years, took that step, but I think that's a decision to be made at the local level for that, and that's one of the reasons that we think it's important to give that opportunity to have feedback. And let's see, and with that, I think, thank you, and Alex, just let you know, I did respond to your email, so if you check your emails, I did it last night.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, our next panel is going to be Carolyn McDermott, Casey Boyd, and Sean Breathwaite. And again, if you have written testimony, I'm going to ask you to limit your speaking time just so we can get to the next bill after this one.
Chair Przonski, members of the committee. My name is Carolyn McDermott, Assistant Chief and Senior Associate Director at the University of Oregon Department of Public Safety. I testify in support of Senate Bill 405. I began my law enforcement career as a police officer for the San Diego Police Department in 1983. After 8 years, I relocated to Eugene, and over the next 17 years, worked as an officer, agent, sergeant, lieutenant, and acting captain for the Eugene Police Department. In 2008, I accepted a senior leadership position at the Department of Public Safety at the University of Oregon, and I currently oversee all department uniform operations. Law enforcement work in a campus environment is rewarding and yet very different and more challenging than my previous experiences. The ambiguity of our current statutory authority is requiring inefficient and effective responses. One, our officers can make an arrest based on probable cause, but we don't have the authority to lodge the suspect into the county corrections facility. The Eugene Police Department must do that on our behalf, as well as introduce cases into circuit court. We are grateful to the Eugene Police Department for assisting us, but recognize the unnecessary duplication of workload required has a negative impact on their availability to provide police services to other areas of the city of Eugene. Our quasi-authority as special campus security officers is confusing for police officers who interact with us. They do not fully understand the limits of our authority and the restriction to campus-owned or controlled property. They recognize we are not equipped nor similarly certified. Likewise, persons contacted for suspicious or criminal behavior on campus question our authority and are reluctant to comply, resulting in physical contact and use of force at times to effect an arrest. I appreciate your attention to this important matter and urge your full support of Senate Bill 405 to ensure that the Department of Public Safety is best able to serve our campus community at the University of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn. Whoever would like to go next?
Good morning, Senator Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Sean Braithwaite, patrol officer with the University of Oregon Department of Public Safety. I strongly support the University of Oregon developing and maintaining their own campus police department. As an officer trained at the Salem, Oregon Police Academy, I recognize that campus police have unique responsibilities. Campus police need to meet recognized standards that will strengthen campus public safety programs, personnel standards, training, and design law enforcement services specific to their campus. This will improve relationships with the community and help establish positive interactions with the community at large. A campus police agency is consistent with national practices for public universities the size of Oregon. Campus Police Department is better able to meet cultural diversity and community-based policing needs specific to the University of Oregon campus. This flexibility increases the capacity to develop unique campus programs, train officers qualified to meet the needs of campus departments. A leadership role in the coordination and developing law enforcement services will provide long-term benefits on having a point of contact for policing and security on campus. Currently, it is difficult to perform all the duties of police department since we lack the tools, training, and resources available to a sworn police department. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Casey.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and other members. My name is Casey Boyd. I'm a patrol lieutenant for the University of Oregon Department of Public Safety. I testify in support of Senate Bill 405. I began my law enforcement career as a federal police officer with the United States Forest Service. Looking to progress in my field, I accepted a leadership position with the University of Oregon Department of Public Safety. During this time, I directly supervised the uniformed officers of the patrol division. One of the daily challenges our officers face is the ability to effectively and safely do their job with minimal training and modified authority. They strive each day to provide the best service possible to campus community with limited authority. Our officers serve a very diverse community and likewise contact citizens for a multitude of reasons. Oftentimes, these contacts are results of criminal behavior which warrant enforcement action. By properly training our officers to the same standard as police officers certified in the state of Oregon, it will afford them the same opportunity to safely return home to their families at the end of each night. Senate Bill 405 will ensure better continuity between law enforcement agencies working in cooperation to better serve the campus and neighboring communities. Presently, our special campus authority limits our officers in enforcement action they are able to take, requiring the assistance of the Eugene Police Department. Frequently, their efforts are unnecessarily repetitious as they will have to conduct similar interviews, investigations, which our officers have already completed. Often, their assistance is solely for the purpose of transporting a person in custody to jail. These much-appreciated efforts of our local police officers are not the most efficient way of providing police services to the greater community of Eugene. This is Sergeant Scott Geating, his wife, and his three daughters. This is Officer Adam Lillengreen, his daughter, their lovely wife, and who's carrying their second child. These two represent numerous officers and families who are members of our department. It's my job to ensure they make it home to their families at the end of every shift. Senate Bill 405 will help provide the proper authority, training, and resources necessary to see this through. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our next panel is going to be Deborah Healy, Malcolm Wilson, and Marilyn Lawrence.
Chair Przanski and the members of the committee, for the record, my name is Deborah Healy.
I live in West University in Eugene, which is a highly student neighborhood. I'm speaking in favor of in support of a sworn police force on campus. I have three perspectives to bring to this, and my comments will be very brief.
Thank you.
As a member of the campus...
Can I get you to take the microphone and bring it down just a little bit? There you go.
Yeah. As a member of the campus community, I see the value in the Department of Public Safety and community policing. We know community policing works, and it's better if we have people on campus as our primary law enforcement who know and understand the campus community. It's a community that is in some ways more diverse than the surrounding community. Victims should be able to report crimes once just to DPS, not two or three times, including the Eugene Police Department. Now, as a resident of West University, with 99% renters and a median age of 22.9, that's 78% of our population is between the ages of probably 18 and 29, I see the good and not so good in this population. I also see a very strong benefit in community policing, people who understand who the students are and, you know, their pluses and minuses. I would really like to see the possibility of using campus police extended into the surrounding neighborhood as needed. These are people who know the population better in many cases than members of the Eugene Police Department. And thirdly, as a former faculty member at Oregon State University for nearly 30 years, we had Oregon State Police on campus there because of the nuclear reactor. They were consistently respectful, professional. They demonstrated very clearly that sworn police officers can do community policing on campus very effectively. So as a member of a highly student neighborhood and a neighborhood association with student members, I appreciate that if DPS has the opportunity to become a fully sworn police department, we will have further discussions about weapons on campus and the tools DPS will use. This is a subject of great debate within my neighborhood. I would like to see, finally, the additional training and respect that DPS could get from being sworn police officers. As the police officers and chiefs have said, this is a factor. And more sharing and of information and training with the EPD, I think, would improve the EPD as much as it benefits the Department of Public Safety. Thank you.
Thank you. Malcolm?
Chairman Brzezinski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for the record, my name is Malcolm Wilson. I'm resident in the South University neighborhood in Eugene and vice president of our neighborhood association. Our neighborhood association strongly supports Bill 405. As you know, the students live in great numbers in the near-campus neighborhoods, and they've had an increasing impact in those neighborhoods as the population of the university has increased. Every week, our neighborhood suffers noise, vandalism, littering, public urination, public sexual activity into the early hours in the morning. A neighbor of mine just a couple of weeks ago reported the following incident. He said, at 3 a.m., my entire family was awoken to a drunken student pounding on the door. While I was phoning the police, the student continued to pound and knock and then lay down in our yard for a minute or two before getting up and walking away. I was, of course, awake for another hour and a half, listening for other disturbances. Now, this is relatively minor stuff, but it's causing a major degradation in our neighborhood, which is a traditional family-oriented neighborhood south of the university. And the Neighborhood Association, with the other agencies in the city, has been working assiduously to solve some of these problems. And according to advice that we've received from Linda King of the University of Nebraska, who's dealt with these issues and is a nationally recognized expert, these problems can only be successfully addressed when all the available resources are brought to bear. Presently, the university's DPS is not able to operate off campus. We strongly believe that if the university police force becomes commissioned and is able to operate off campus, they will be able to do all the things that are necessary to serve their own student community and the community in which the students are located. This is, of course, from the perspective of our neighborhood, an issue of the disturbances in the civil quality of life. But for the students themselves, additional police protection will provide protection from
from burglary, which happens quite regularly, especially during the student holidays. So for a number of reasons, then, the Neighborhood Association supports this bill.
Great. Thank you. Marilyn.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The purpose for my testimony is to identify for committee members that Senate Bill 405 does make the changes that are needed in the enabling statutes for our department to be able to treat Oregon University System police officers as we would any others. Those changes are made in the definitions of law enforcement unit and police officer that would allow such commissioned police officers to be treated as any other police officer under the jurisdiction of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The information in our written testimony cites information provided by the Oregon University system about the numbers of officers that would be anticipated to be phasing in over the four-year period that would have been our fiscal analysis. And so our information in the written testimony and in our fiscal impact statement on the bill is based on the information from the Oregon University system that in that anticipated period of time, only the University of Oregon anticipates transitioning to a police force. They provided phase-in information that had been developed by the University of Oregon, and that indicates an estimated 4 officers maximum per year for a couple of years, and then 4 officers per year for the next 2 as they are in their several-year transition plan. Our department is not able to predict with certainty the number of hires that any police department is going to make, but at a rate of 5 officers per year, that is within the normal fluctuation that we would see as we anticipate trying to determine how many basic police classes would be needed in any biennium. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Senator Wissett first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the projected cost to the University of Oregon for training a police officer?
Chair Przanski and Senator Whitsitt, there is no provision in Senate Bill 405 for the University of Oregon to reimburse for the cost of training, as there is not for any other police department. And so that cost would be borne out of the criminal fines and assessments that fund the rest of the basic police training for the state.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. We have another panel and a half. Brian Glassmith, why don't you come on up? Cimarron Gillespie and Gregory Manny Garcia. Okay. Well, then let's go ahead and I will call up Sam Chapman if he's in the room. Brian, why don't you go ahead and get started?
For the record, I'm Brian Gillespie. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I have the unfortunate distinction of being the first person that's speaking against the bill. But after discussions with the chair of the committee about the intent and potentially how it would be administered, I think we may be able to work through that. But let me just touch on a couple of points. I do represent the, as I mentioned, the Oregon Council of Police Associations, which member organizations, the Lane County Deputies Association, as well as the Eugene Police Employees Association, both of which replied back to us that they can and have in the past contracted for these services, and that would be their preference. Given that, I will echo the comments that were made by Kevin Campbell in support of the bill, that as long as the following conditions are met, we would be willing to reconsider our position. Full requirement of the 16-week DPSST training, that they have all of the functions that any other police officer in the state would have as far as review by DPSST. Require the leadership of this police force to, in fact, be certified at the management level. The one concern that we do have, based upon the passage of the bill for OHSU last session, and it's already been brought up, is the arming issue. We are aware that the fact that the officers are not armed at OHSU has caused problems for the Portland Police Bureau and the Portland Police Association. We obviously have some concerns that if they were not to be armed, that leads to a situation in which our officers, when they do come on campus, oftentimes would face additional dangers because the situation had escalated. The other concern that we had in reading the bill was whether or not they were fully PERS and PERS PNF. We would want to make sure that if these folks, in fact, are fully certified the same way and have the same authority, rights, responsibilities as any other police officer in the state of Oregon, that in fact they are fully covered by PERS and by PERS PNF the same as any other officer in the state. And the last concern in reading the bill is on line 15 and 16, and it may be a matter of interpretation, but in reading that, my folks reacted to may enforce criminal laws and any other administrative rules and policies adopted by the board or commissioning university. Board, of course, referring to the state board. They had concerns about the board limiting the authority of both the administration of the police agency and the individual officers to only enforce certain laws and look the other way on other laws. And obviously, we would like, if they're fully commissioned as police officers and have all the other tools that a police officer, that in fact they're not being directed to not look at certain things and look at other things. And with that, I'll end. Thank you.
Thank you. Brian, stay there, please. Gentlemen, whoever would like to go next, give us your name and your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chairman Brzezinski. My name is Cimarron Gillespie, and I'm a student at the University of Oregon. I'm speaking in opposition to this bill. The University of Oregon's public safety organization, DPS, is unique and should remain that way. The creation of an armed police force would only introduce weapons into a situation that does not require them. The ability to maintain the levels of campus safety that we have is a testament to the capacity of students to interact in a civil manner. To add weapons would only signify a distrust in the ability of students to be thoughtful, concerned citizens. The unique relationship of service that DPS provides to students is one that includes education. By adding guns and other weaponry, we risk tipping that balance into one of authority and violence. Making DPS or any security force into a police agency will not increase security. It is the person and not their weapons, the relationships and not retaliation, that will serve any environment and will secure any environment. In any situation where security would need a firearm, they should be calling a SWAT team for anyways. Any large crowd that they would use firearms to control would either lead to a massacre, or they should be calling for riot patrol. Transferring the authority of a security force to a police force will also make the police officers able to be called away to respond to disaster emergency situations. This will leave the campuses vulnerable. This is, in my opinion, one of the greatest risks to all the campuses, that the security forces, which are present, they remain on campus. But if they become private police forces, they will be called away. When the situation gets out of control in Eugene or Springfield, both the EPD and the Springfield Police Force respond, along with the Lane County Sheriff's and sometimes the state troopers. If there was an emergency, the campus forces would be called away. There's also the question of oversight. And I was listening earlier, thank you, Brzezinski, for requiring the inclusion of an oversight board. Even though I cannot foresee a circumstance in which a campus police officer would need to use a firearm, because if they would, they should be calling on a different agency to respond to that. Supposing that they do, what will hold them back from misuse of that trust? What prevents a disaster? Where is the oversight? Who will administer justice to the people charged with administering justice? Already in the EPD, the cover-up of the Roger Magana scandal, with the systematic sexual assault and demanding of favors by police officer Magana. A power position that police officers have gives them authority. And right now, the EPD, a fully trained police force, has little oversight, allowing the dubious circumstances of tasing involving a Chinese foreign exchange student and a student at a peaceful protest. This lack of oversight is gravely concerning. Until this question is answered of oversight, until we have these details worked out, there is no good reason to allow more police forces to proceed.
Ron, I'm going to need you to finish up. I've got three more people, and then we have another bill I have to get to.
Okay. First and foremost, we need oversight. And I think this is a very high cost. And there's another question here of if there's a legal problem in the future, who will pay the cost? Will it be the university? Will it be the state? Will it be the taxpayers? This is unclear. And as you make this decision, please consider this quote, that the instruments which are set up to safeguard our rights will become the very whips with which the free are struck.
Thank you very much.
Hello, thank you, Senator Przanski and committee members. My name is Sam Chapman, for the record. I am a current junior at the University of Oregon here to testify in opposition to Bill 405. I would like to rebuttal a couple of remarks that were made earlier in that I believe it was mentioned that DPS cannot carry guns or tasers. Maybe a DPS member can back me up on this. They have the right to carry tasers, but they choose not to. So I just wanted to clarify that. And on top of that, this is just for students. This is a student issue. And as it's already been mentioned earlier in testimony, this is a very heavily weighted issue on the side of DPS and other organizations, not the students. I am here, along with Sims and a couple other students, to represent over 2,000 students that have signed a petition opposing the new partnership and DPS turning into a potentially armed police force. So on the issue of potentially armed, I say potentially armed because we've had a serious problem with transparency between students and DPS. They've mentioned many times that yes, they have had meetings, public hearings, things like that. Students have been involved, but they have never sat down with us and asked us, what do you think about a Department of Public Safety? What would you like to see? This is a student issue that is not being recognized by the students. And they have yet, we have asked them multiple times, are you going to carry guns on campus? And we have never gotten a straight answer. That is a problem in the eyes of students. If we cannot know whether they are going to arm themselves, I quote, it's an issue that's going to be decided later down the road. That's not acceptable for students. We want to know if the people that are supposed to protect us and keep us safe are going to be using deadly force on campus. That's something that everyone wants to know. That's an issue for minorities. That's an issue for the activist atmosphere that makes the University of Oregon what it is today. I would also like to mention that there's been a lot of stats thrown around about the Pac-12 and other schools that have their own police agency. I believe it's about 90% of the nation has its own police force, and I believe it was 10 of the 12 schools in the Pac-12 that have their own police entities. I would like to mention that none of those schools are in Oregon. The only one is OSU, and as it was mentioned earlier, it's because they are federally required to have an armed police agency on their campus because they have a nuclear reactor. Another thing that was brought up by some of the DPS members was that what if a shooting like the Virginia Tech shooting or NIU was to happen? What then? I mean, that's a legitimate question. That's questions that we answered all the time on campus. Well, you know, that's the first fear. What if there's a shooting on campus? The answer is we don't have metal detectors on the edge of campus. There's nothing that is going to stop a person from bringing a gun onto campus. It's a cynical idea, but it's reality. If someone wants to bring a gun on campus and pull it out, I'm sorry, they're going to be able to do that. And fantasizing about a cop being in the exact place at the exact time of that gun being pulled out, I'm sorry, it's not realistic for students. We can't believe that. I mean, I'll wrap up. Yeah. So. I'm just here to represent a large majority and a growing majority at that. We will continue to submit signatures from the student body in opposing this bill. And I would like to thank you for your time, and please consider outreaching to students as much as you can. We're going to continue to outreach to you, and we would really like to work with you on this. This is a student issue that students need to be addressing. We are working on that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions for anyone on the panel?
A quick question?
You may.
Thank you. I just want to ask the students a question, and thanks for coming up and testifying. I don't know if it's your spring break, but thanks for being here.
It is.
I wanted to ask you mentioned that if there's a situation that needs police, the Eugene police or the Springfield police or the sheriff respond. So don't you think it would be better to have someone responding who actually knows the campus and who is specifically trained in campus issues? I think that's the big question I have for you.
I think it depends on the issue. And one of the things about this specifically is that what makes this different, as different situation now, turning DPS into a police force, is that their power of arrest and their ability to carry firearms. Those are two of the most significant factors in relating to this specific bill. And in terms of powers of arrest, it may speed up the apprehension of a suspect, but in terms of carrying firearms, there isn't a situation where I could foresee them responding to it and needing to use a firearm in that situation, where they shouldn't be calling an outside agency anyways, because they wouldn't be carrying, they wouldn't be walking around with bulletproof vests on every day and able to respond to situations where they would be answering to a gunman on campus anyways. And there's students in the overflow room who are opposed to this as well, who are not in here because the room is full.
All right. Thank you very much. Brian, just regarding your issues that you raised, I believe all of them have been addressed in the bill with the exception of the last one, and we can talk about the clarification on the how broad it would be.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for coming up. I appreciate you being here on your spring break and giving us your testimony. I had two other people, I believe, that were listed on the to give testimony today, and that is Greg Marks, and then I will call again, I guess it was George Manny Garcia, if he is in the room. Again, we're running really short on time. I've got another major bill with a lot of people here that I need to take their testimony to.
Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Greg Marks. I'm a state member, board member of SEIU, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 405. This is a bill that SEIU has been working on for numerous years. I've had the distinct pleasure of contacting and working emails with Senator Mamichi on this. This bill will address some serious concerns that SEIU has. One is the safety of our employees at the campuses and the students and the faculty. Right now, we aren't able to protect ourselves. How can we protect the campuses? This bill will allow us to do that. This bill also mandates training. There is no statewide standard for campus public safety officers. This bill would give those universities that choose the ability to have the same standard as every police department in the state. My day job is I'm the graveyard sergeant at PSU. While I'm not here representing PSU, I can answer some questions for you about PSU if the committee has any.
All right, thank you. And Gregory.
Yeah. My name is Manny Garcia. I want to thank the chair and the committee for being here today. I'm a freshman at the University of Oregon, and I'm here today to speak about the cost and in its opposition to Senate Bill 405. So in 2007, this same bill, or one similar to its cost, was estimated at $4 million. And while I wasn't aware that the Oregon legislature was looking to increase its expenditures during this legislative session, there are better uses for this money that can make students safe on campus or improve accessibility to students on campus, other than arming our Department of Public Safety officers. For example, as mentioned earlier, we've seen two students tased in the past few years and hundreds of others tear-gassed. We believe that it would be better to use this money to train the police force we already have to better deal with students, as not to be using these kinds of force against them. It would also be useful to install more blue boxes around campus, which are used to contact the Department of Public Safety in the case that an emergency arises. There are parts of our campus where you cannot see these blue boxes, and as a result, you cannot call for help if you need it. The Oregon Student Association would also prefer that we use this money to spend on increasing opportunity grants or other sources of funding for our university to allow more students to attend higher education instead of arming police officers. I hope that the committee considers these other expenditures it could make to improve our public safety and improve our higher education rather than arming our police force, and I thank you for hearing me today.
All right, thank you. Questions?
A question for council.
All right.
Could you direct us to the 2007 bill that was referenced in the fiscal, please?
I can follow up with all the members, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Chair, I remember I was on the House Judiciary Committee, and that's where the bill was heard. I don't remember the number, but we had significant discussions about it. And coincidentally, it was first scheduled for a public hearing, I think, the same week as the Virginia Tech shooting. So it was rescheduled for a week or two after that. We had lengthy discussions about the issue in 2000.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing at this time on Senate Bill 405. Unless there's someone else that wanted to give testimony that I didn't see or have on the list, we'll close that public hearing. We're going to open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 412. And counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 412 provides state law enforcement authority to tribal police officers who are certified by the Department of Public Safety Standards and whose employing tribal governments comply with certain conditions, including meeting certain insurance requirements and waiving sovereign immunity from tort liability for claims that arise from action taken under the measure. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There are a number of amendments available to the members. The Dash 1 amendment eliminates creation of a unique category of certification by DPSST. It eliminates substantive compliance review by DPSST, requires tribal governments to tender resolution to waive sovereign immunity. The Dash 3 amendment incorporates the Dash 1 and sunsets the measure on January 1st, 2016. The Dash 4 incorporates the Dash 1, but requires tribal governments to codify their waiver of sovereign immunity in tribal code. The Dash 5 amendment incorporates the Dash 1 and limits the scope of authorized conduct to preclude initiation of law enforcement activities outside territorial jurisdiction of the tribal government. And the Dash 6 also incorporates the Dash 1 and prohibits receipt of funds by tribal governments for law enforcement activities authorized under the measure.
All right, thank you. Before we get started, Senator Farioli, I see that you're here. I understand you want to give testimony. Did you want to give testimony before we get started with the first panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the courtesy. Senator Ted Farioli, District 30. All I really want to do is encourage a solution to a problem that you've been hearing about. We simply need to have a situation where the law enforcement community has a clear understanding of what their jurisdictional authorities are, and that we also respect a difficult concept for us to get our arms around, and that's tribal sovereignty. So those two issues have to find a balancing point. We need lawful authority in all of our law enforcement agencies, and we need a clear understanding about how these jurisdictional issues comport with each other. And, Mr. Chairman, I know that you have the horsepower on your committee to find a solution.
So thank you very much.
Just offer that word of encouragement.
We appreciate that. It looks like Senator Dingfelder is not going to let you leave the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator. Yeah, I'm just curious if you support this bill or not. I couldn't quite tell from your remarks.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I support a solution that allows tribal police officers to have jurisdictional authority that they need to protect public safety, and that the surrounding jurisdictions also have clear understanding about where their authorities, their mutual authorities, coincide. So we need some real clear definitions, but we need real clear understanding. I will tell you from a citizen's perspective, when you dial 911, you don't care what color the uniform is. You know, you want some protection, and whether you're on the reservation or off the reservation, it's really important that we have a response capability that is jurisdictionally sound and that is public safety oriented. So, you know, you'll see a variety of amendments to this bill. I believe that somewhere among the amendments is the perfect solution, or as close as we can get to that. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Pete, why don't you come back up? Thank you, Senator. And I'm going to let you three lead us off this discussion. All right, Howie.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Howard Arnett. I am tribal attorney for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon, and I will try to briefly summarize my written statement, and in doing so, I want to make two points. The first is I want to try to discuss and make a complex issue on a complex situation simple and describe how the problem came about that Senate Bill 412 seeks to address. And second, I want to briefly discuss and point out that this problem is not unique to Oregon, that other western states with large Indian populations have experienced the same issue and have addressed it in a very similar manner to Senate Bill 412. First, the problem. The origin of the issue that Senate Bill 412 seeks to address is the fact that the nine Indian tribes in Oregon are essentially sovereign nations within the boundaries of the state of Oregon. My written statement explains some of the reasons why that is the fact, but as a result of their sovereign status within the boundaries of the state of Oregon, the tribes have the authority and the ability to exercise their inherent sovereignty, to make their own laws and to be governed by them. And as a result of that, a number of tribes, there are now six, in fact, that have police departments that police Indian lands and Indian people within the boundaries of the state of Oregon. Five of them are operated by tribes, and one is an intertribal law enforcement program on the Columbia River. Now, these tribal police departments in Oregon essentially look and act just like any other police or law enforcement agency in the state of Oregon. And most importantly, they go through the same training and certification process through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training as all other officers in the state of Oregon. That's true across the board for all six tribal law enforcement agencies in Oregon. However, there is one very significant difference between the tribal law enforcement agencies and the state and local law enforcement agencies in Oregon. And this is the root of the problem that Senate Bill 412 seeks to address. The problem is the tribal agencies, the tribal police officers, and the tribal governments themselves lack criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians who they encounter in the course of their police and law enforcement duties. That's the result of a 1978 Supreme Court decision that said the tribes only have criminal jurisdiction over Indians, members of federally recognized tribes. Everybody else, they lack criminal jurisdiction over. That's a problem. What happens when a tribal officer encounters a non-Indian in the course of his patrol duties or his law enforcement duties in his tribe's Indian country? That's a significant issue. These non-Indian criminal suspects are subject, for the most part, to state law. The solution to the problem is clearly to give the tribal officers the authority to enforce state law and subject these non-Indian offenders they encounter within their own jurisdiction to state authorities and issue citations that go to state court. And there are two ways that can be done. One would be through deputization agreements with the local sheriffs. The other would be a change to state law that clearly allows tribal officers the authority to enforce state law against the non-Indian offenders they encounter in the course of their law enforcement activities. The deputization agreements at Warm Springs have worked sometimes and sometimes not. Currently, the tribe has deputization agreements with both Wasco and Jefferson counties, which are the two counties that the reservation occupies, but that's a fairly recent development. For many, many years, the tribe had deputization agreements with neither county. The better solution, in our view, is a statutory fix to the problem, an authorization for tribal officers to exercise state authority, and that's what Senate Bill 412 does. Interestingly, this same problem has been faced by a number of other states with large Indian populations and reservations within their boundaries. Our research has shown that at least a half a dozen Western states have legislative fixes similar to Senate Bill 412. The one that comes the closest to Senate Bill 412 is the Arizona statute. It's been on the book for since 1972. Arizona is probably the biggest Indian state in the country. There are two dozen reservations occupying about a fifth of the state's land base. There's no state jurisdiction on any of those reservations. All of those tribes have their own police departments. And in the 40 years or so that that statute has been in effect in Arizona, where the state officers, the tribal officers, receive state certification, go through the state training program, and are authorized to issue state citations and make state arrests, there's never been a challenge to the constitutionality of the Arizona statute. And there have only been a handful of cases, four, I think, that we found in our research, that even discussed the statutes. And those just were about whether or not the tribal officer was acting within or without his authority under the Arizona statute. So it's worked in Arizona. The solution has worked in other states. And we believe it will work in Oregon if Senate Bill 412 is enacted. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go any further, I'm going to give notice to those people that are here on Senate Bill 421, Senate Bill 731, Senate Bill 740, Senate Bill 774. Those are all set today for public hearing and possible work session. They will not be heard today. We will not have time. We are carrying those bills over to Monday, this next Monday. So if you're here on those bills, please feel free to leave. I apologize. We had a packed schedule with as many people that we've had turn out. Regarding the work sessions, they also will be carried over till Monday, Senate Bill 347, 385, and 387. With that, Pete.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. Mr. Bob Garcia, the chairman of our tribe, traveled here from Coos County. I think he's in the overflow room, and later this morning you'll hear from Brad Nieper, the chief of our police department. It seems to me this bill presents two key policy questions for you to decide. First, does the bill yield an increase in public safety for all Oregonians, members of tribes or not? And second, in terms of the secondary policy question, is whether the bill adequately addresses the collateral implications of achieving that improvement in public safety. Mr. Chair, we support the Dash 1 or the Dash 4 amendments. Either would be fine with us, and we would support either one of them. And we have no position in opposition or in support of the Dash 3, 5, or 6 amendments. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've reduced my testimony to a chart that you have in front of you, and with your permission, I'll just use the bigger version of it here to briefly illustrate some key points about the bill.
You bet. And I'm going to ask Tim if you can move over, because, Pete, I'm going to have to try to have you as close to the microphone as possible.
I'll project in my best courtroom.
There we go. And I know you can.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, start by falling over the curb.
I'll see the state on that one.
The chart traces State Boulevard 412 across several different jurisdictions. And I'll leave off the state of Washington for the moment, but it's on the chart simply to illustrate the fact that questions of sovereignty and the relationship of sovereignty to public safety are not unique to the interactions between tribes and states. You also confront those when you cross the sovereign borders of a state. So let me first address this. The key question is the yield of public safety. In the county and on tribal lands, as Mr. Arnett has already described, tribal police officers currently are at a disadvantage, identified by the red dot here, in terms of yield of making arrests and doing all of the things that other sworn officers in the state can do. The bill solves that problem with respect to matters that take place in counties or off tribal lands. It equalizes that so that now the same yield of public safety is available whether the tribal police officer is involved or whether it's an officer from another jurisdiction. That's true also, of course, in city jurisdictions. And in the two kinds of tribal lands that we have in Oregon, Public Law 280 and non-Public Law 280 lands, those are treated slightly different under federal law, and it has an interesting consequence for the public safety benefits of Senate Bill 412. But with respect to Public Law 280 lands, again, the bill achieves an equalization of enforcement authority so as to all of the reservations except for the Warm Springs, Umatilla, Burns, Paiute. The yield of this bill is that on reservation lands or off, tribal law enforcement officers have the same authority as non-tribal law enforcement officers. On non-public law 280 lands, my client is not one of those tribes, and I don't presume to speak for any of the tribes listed, but those tribes are the Warm Springs, Umatilla, and Burns Paiute. Again, with respect to the enforcement, the public safety yield as to non-Indians who commit crimes on non-public law 280 lands, the bill achieves a full equalization of authority as to those, yielding that public safety benefit. A non-Indian committing an offense on a non-public law 280 land would be subject to the same authority under the bill, whether the officer was a tribal officer or not. On non-public law 280 lands only, there is, under current law and remaining under the bill, a difference, and that is because on non-public law 280 lands, tribal officers only and exclusively as a matter of federal law have enforcement authority as to Indians who commit crimes on that land. So even if Senate Bill 412 passes on non-public law 280 lands, then a non-tribal officer still would lack authority. The bill doesn't solve that problem. Let me turn to the secondary matters that your work group examined in a great deal of detail, and I think that we have solved all of these. First one is, if we're going to authorize tribal officers to do this and they make an error that would expose one of their non-tribal colleagues to tort liability, they should be exposed to the same kind of liability. And we think we've solved that problem both for circumstances in which a tribal law enforcement officer is acting together with another law enforcement officer and they jointly do something that causes it creates tort or tort liability. So we think we've solved that for the side-by-side situation. We think we've also solved that for the situation in which a tribal officer is acting independently of any other officer. So again, we think we've equalized that, the tort liability question. We've also, we believe, solved the regulatory oversight problem. Under the bill, in contrast to current law, police officers employed by a tribal police department and their supervisors will be fully subject to DPSST regulatory authority. But that is not currently true under current law. So what that yields then are two red dots down here. We can't solve the Washington-Oregon sovereignty problem. That's beyond the scope of this bill. It leaves two red dots that aren't solved. One is public records that are unconnected with a particular case. And we've heard that this is a concern about Senate Bill 412, that somehow it doesn't achieve a situation in which the tribe is subject equally to a police department, generally to the Oregon public records law. And that's true. But with respect to public records that are pertinent to a prosecution or another police action, the bill does, and current law, does already create the necessity that the tribe would provide public records. It would give access to those because if a tribal law enforcement officer took an action and records were necessary in order for the defendant of that action to defend the criminal case that resulted, the tribe would have to provide those records or else the criminal prosecution would be dismissed. So the same incentive under current law would apply both to tribal officers, police departments as it does to other police departments. The bill doesn't purport to make tribes subject to the public records law as to records that aren't related to criminal enforcement, but that makes sense that it wouldn't because this is a criminal enforcement public safety issue. And the only remaining public safety issue is this red dot here as to non-PL 280 tribes and only as to the authority of a non-tribal officer on that tribal land to arrest an Indian suspect. And that's the so-called reciprocity issue. And that's a very profound issue for the tribes that are in that category, and I'm not going to speak for them. The bill does not solve that. So the residual public safety question as to that primary issue is whether these other achievements and these other yields to the advantage of public safety and the way that we've solved the collateral implications, whether those are worth doing despite the fact that we haven't yet solved that reciprocity question. And our position is that we should do that.
Thank you.
While you're up there, well, you don't have to be there, I guess. Mr. Chair, if I could, that last red dot, I just want to make sure let's say, for example, it's anybody, whether it's a tribal member, non-tribal member, does something on non-tribal land, and in hot pursuit, the non-tribal officer goes onto tribal land. It's an action that was committed on non-tribal land. Does that officer have jurisdiction on tribal land at that point? So all that is talking about is actions that happened on tribal land. That last red dot.
I'll let Mr. Arnett address that because he represents one of those non-PL2A.
That circumstance has come up. The Warm Springs Tribe has a tribal code, tribal law provision that specifically permits hot pursuit by off-reservation law enforcement onto the reservation where tribal officers assist and effect a state arrest because the offense occurred in state jurisdiction. In fact, there's a case being argued today in the Oregon Court of Appeals that actually addresses that issue.
Okay, well, the question is, I mean, you have an agreement.
Yes, we do.
I'm just wondering if it's the same on other non-280 lands, or does it have to be specifically by agreement? I mean, you know, it's the hot pursuit issue going both ways, I think is important, and the jurisdiction that applies.
I can't speak to the other non-280 reservations. Tim?
Under our MOU with Umatilla County, I believe that's in there. We do have
Tim, I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Tim Edelman. I'm Chief of Police for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation.
All right. You want to get his testimony first, or do you want to ask?
No, go ahead.
Tim, why don't you give us your brief testimony, and I'm just going to let people know that are here. I'm going to stay. I don't know what my committee can do. At 10 o'clock, they have other assignments. I'm clearing part of mine so I can continue to take testimony. So we will try to get as many people on, especially those who have traveled great distances. Tim.
Thank you, Senator Przanski and committee members. I've already introduced myself. I want to talk a little bit about my prior experience here in Oregon. I'm retired from the Washington County Sheriff's Office as lieutenant, and I have 33 years of law enforcement experience here in within the state of Oregon. With this background and experience, I strongly urge you to pass Senate Bill 412. You have a considerable written testimony. I'm a part. I'll try and be as brief as possible. Some of the things I wanted to hit, as you know, the Kurtz case caused a real problem within Indian country. Part of the, one of the biggest problems with it was is that it, in essence, encourages non-Indians to ignore tribal law enforcement. There are other situations that pose problems on and off the reservation force as well. Fixing the Kurtz case basically is going to require that we have the same enforcement abilities that our other brother and sister law enforcement officers do throughout the state. Without that kind of jurisdiction, there's simply any kind of crimes committed against tribal officers, there's no jurisdiction that's going to be able to enforce any action against those violators. I won't go into the great detail, but it's in my testimony that especially within our tribe anyway, our police department, all of our officers go to the police academy, and we are subject and we exceed in most cases the maintenance standards that are required on officers. So all of our officers are certified, including myself as a chief. I do have an executive certification, so we try and meet the highest standards that we possibly can. As you know, with this bill, we were in three committee meetings discussing this, and quite frankly, the amendments that are being proposed here to this bill I think are fair, and I think we should just move on to that, move on with that, and get a vote on the bill, and I encourage its passage. When, excuse me, when the, as I said, when the Kurtz case was passed down to us, it created a real dilemma for us. On my reservation, approximately half of our population is non-Indian. So within our boundaries, if we have a crime where it's a non-Indian on non-Indian, without a fix to this, we cannot take any enforcement action. The best that we can hope for is stabilize the situation and hope that a Umatilla County deputy is available or a state police officer. And I can tell you their resources are stretched very thin there as well. This also includes situations as far as traffic enforcement and traffic safety within our community. Without this fix, we could possibly have a non-Indian motorist going through Indian country, say at speeds in excess of 100 miles an hour, and if they wanted to, they could choose to ignore us and keep on going. And we would not be able to do anything about that unless a sheriff's deputy or state police officer is nearby who could possibly get them stopped.
Tim, I need you to wrap up. I need to get two other panels in.
Okay. I just want to talk to the reciprocity issue real quick. As you, Mr. Shepard, put it very clearly on that. But the one of the points I want to make as far as on, like, our lands, the tribe that we are non-PL 280, this shouldn't be an issue. I earlier made an example of this. It's no different than to look at this as a municipality. State police and sheriff's deputies cannot go into a city and enforce city code unless that city code has adopted state statutes. So in essence, all they're doing is enforcing state statutes. But if it's a code that's unique to that city, they have no authority to enforce that unless there's some sort of MOU. So it's no different with the tribe. I don't understand why they would want to come on the reservation. In essence, the only thing that we're missing here is they cannot enforce tribal codes on tribal members and put them into tribal court. At any rate, I'll wrap it up. I strongly urge you to pass this bill and for the sake of public and law enforcement safety.
All right, thank you. Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I apologize. I have a great deal of interest in this bill. I've had conversations with with the folks down in my two tribes, and their interest right now is mostly reciprocity. They want us to work the same both ways, inside out, whatever. And of course, they aren't non 280 tribes, so maybe this bill fixes that, and maybe I'm okay with those provisions, but it needs to be statewide. And I'm still not quite sure I understand whether there's actual true reciprocity on the non 280 lands, or whether that's a federal issue that we really can't deal with.
That's what it is.
Senator Whitson. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. In previous testimony, there was a reference to a United States Supreme Court decision that apparently in some way limits the authority of tribal officers off of sovereign tribal land. If that is in fact the case, how is it that an Oregon statute would override a United States Supreme Court decision?
Actually, that decision is called Oliphant versus Suquamish Tribe, and the Supreme Court held that tribal officers lack the authority under tribal law to enforce tribal criminal statutes against non-Indians, which usually they only apply within the reservation boundaries. So it doesn't relate to the issue addressed in SB 412. SB 412 is authorizing tribal officers to essentially enforce state law against non-Indians. They're not enforcing tribal law. Enforcing state law, they would be considered police officers under Oregon statutes and thereby empowered to enforce state law against non-Indians. The Oliphant case is about enforcing tribal criminal jurisdiction against non-Indians, and that's what the Supreme Court said tribes cannot do.
Thank you.
Yeah, I had just one question, and then I apologize if constituents waiting for me in my office, so they won't be able to hear the rest of this. But regarding, I was trying to figure out the difference between for tribal law and state law. One question I had is for both Warm Springs and Umatilla, you have large casinos. So how do you deal with that if you have an issue? You have a lot of non-Indians, obviously, coming into your reservation to frequent those casinos. Has it not been an issue before? Because what I'm hearing is then you can't enforce state law against non-Indians that are coming in and frequenting the casinos, but you could enforce tribal law. So am I understanding this right? And has this not been an issue then or any problems with your casino activities?
Well, I can try to answer for Warm Springs. Actually, the casino is not large at Warm Springs, but the Umatilla casino is quite a bit larger and has a larger non-Indian clientele. But the casino at Warm Springs is...
I was thinking about Kenita.
It is. It is at Kenita, and that's actually in Wasco County, and the tribe has had to deal with situations there involving non-Indians as best it can and essentially hold those folks for the Wasco County Sheriff's deputies to actually affect state law arrests. At least that's my understanding. The chief of the Warm Springs Police Department will be on the next panel, and he can clarify and perhaps answer that question better.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder, likewise, the chief of the my client will be on the next panel. I think he's best to answer that.
Okay. For us at the Umatilla, we've had an agreement, deputation agreement, with the sheriff's office there, so that's allowed us to do some enforcement. But I should add that not all of my officers are deputized, so if one of my officers is not deputized, then he has no enforcement authority over anyone there other than tribal or Indians.
All right, thank you. What I'm going to do is ask y'all to step back. I'm going to take the three that are from over 100 miles, then I'm going to come back to the sheriff's panel and do that next so we make sure we have that testimony in. Brad Kemper, Carmen Smith, Leo Stewart. And gentlemen, you know our time restraints. The best you can do to be brief. If you have written testimony, please do not read it.
Thank you. My name is Leo Stewart. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. You have already heard the background and the reason why this legislation is very important to our people. We want to come here and let you know that our tribal government has also considered this issue and passed resolution in support of the passage of Senate Bill 412. I would like to take a moment to acknowledge the value of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services and our government-to-government process. That process has allowed us to deliberate this issue among the tribes and the state, and it provided the opportunity for input by our legislative representatives, Senator Ted Ferrioli and Representative Arnie Reblin. Their insight and support has been valuable and helped lead to the legislation you have before you. We thank you for the hearing of this bill and urge prompt action so that our police officers can continue to keep both our communities and your community safe. I thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, who would ever like to go next, please?
I'll go next. Thank you, Chairman Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Brad Nieper. I'm the Chief of Police for the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Loramquan, Siuslaw Indians. I have 24 years of law enforcement experience, 17 years of that with the Oregon State Police, and 7 years with the Tribal Police Department. I am testifying, obviously, in support of Senate Bill 412. I would like to talk briefly about a real incident that occurred, one of many incidents, in fact, that to me points out the negative effects of us tribal police officers not having authority to make state arrests. On August 11th, 2010, at about 8:40 a.m., I was southbound from my Florence office to the Coos Bay tribal offices. When I reached the city limits, just outside the city limits of Florence, I observed two males hitchhiking on the south end of the Siuslaw River Bridge. One of those appeared to me to resemble a wanted suspect out of Washington State that was wanted for rape and kidnapping. I had seen a wanted flyer on that suspect the day before. I went on past out of sight, turned around, came back to take another look. Once I got another look, of course, the bridge came up, and which isolated me from police officers who had that authority. I called the Florence Police Department, advised them that I saw, and when I saw the suspect a second time, it confirmed to me that that was indeed John Allen Carter. I was in contact with Florence Police Department. They were stuck on the other side of the bridge. I watched Mr. Carter walk southbound. He had come onto the bridge and left, and luckily the bridge came down and Florence Police Department was able to make the rest. I accompanied them on that contact. This is just one of many incidents. Had he attempted to flee, if he realized that I was a police officer, I was driving an unmarked patrol vehicle and I was not in uniform, but we did make eye contact, and most people do recognize that vehicle as a police vehicle because it has push bars, antennas, and all the typical stuff. It's very easily possible that he could have escaped. After that arrest, I received personal phone calls from his victim, a personal letter from a previous victim, and notes from family members thanking me for what I did that day.
Brad, I hate to do this, but I need you to wrap up, please.
Okay, that's all I have. I respectfully request your support for this legislation.
Thank you very much.
Well, good morning, Chairman Kathy and committee members. I'm Carmen Smith. I'm the Chief of Police of Warren Springs Confederate Tribes, and I'm here to present testimony in support of Senate Bill 412. I have worked with law enforcement at Warren Springs since 1992 as a tribal police officer and as the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I have 28 years of experience, and I have had the honor the last 5 years as being the Chief of Police of Warren Springs. We all know about the Kurtz State versus Kurtz. We've covered that quite a bit. But it affects Warren Springs because of the non-Indians that come on Warren Springs. And that's where the jurisdictional part is a problem for us because we don't have the authority to arrest or or deal with the non-Indians that come on. In the past, we've had the main thoroughfare is Highway 26 that comes through from Portland to Central Oregon through Warm Springs. And there's thousands of citizens that come through there, and we have a lot of accidents that occur on the reservation and off the reservation. And I want to make a point about that because we're the closest police department available in any response on the reservation or right outside that. Although we're half of the reservation is Jefferson County, the other half is Wasco County. So when a call comes in, we're the first ones to respond. And like Senator Fraley said earlier, when we respond, they don't ask us, are you a state officer, are you state certified, are you allowed to be out here to help us? They just want help, and we're there to help them, and we do that. And we got several letters that's come to our department through the years on appreciation for us being there and responding to their accident or on their behalf. And so with that, this needs to be fixed. This will help us better protect the community, protect the members of the Warm Springs Tribe, and the citizens of Oregon to have this law in the state legislature as us being police officers. And it's critical to us, critical to not just our tribe, but all the tribes in Oregon, especially the ones with law enforcement authority. So with that, I'll just keep it short that I think this should pass and it should go forward. And it would be the best for us and the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. I'm sorry for the rush.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to call up Sheriff Wolf, John Powell, and Brian Dunlap-Smith, please. Bob, you can go first.
Sure. Good morning, Senator Brzezinski and members of the committee. My name is Bob Wolf. I'm the sheriff of Polk County, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And I'm here to offer testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 412. This legislation provides tribal police who obtain their authority from a sovereign tribal nation, which is not part of the state of Oregon, more enforcement authority than any other state, county, or municipal officer in the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 412 does not require tribal police agencies to certify compliance with Oregon state laws other than requiring insurance levels matching Oregon's torts liability limits. Other statutes that make law enforcement agencies accountable to the people, such as the Open Records Law, Records Retention Law, or the Preservation of Evidence Act that you'll be hearing today, or maybe not, will be governing tribal police agencies if this bill passes. In other words, Senate Bill 412 and all but one of the amendments, the tribal police agencies get all the powers of state-regulated police agencies without the requisite statutory protections for the rights of the citizens that they serve. And therefore, we cannot support this legislation as good public policy. The Senate Bill 412 does not serve the best interests of the citizens of Oregon, but does address the specific needs of the tribal government. In fact, it goes beyond their needs to self-govern by granting tribal police officers law enforcement authority over citizens of Oregon while off their reservation. Members of the committee have heard about the Kurtz case, in which a Warm Springs officer pursued Mr. Kurtz off the reservation and subsequently arrested him. That particular case is still awaiting a decision from the courts as to the authority of the tribal officer off of a reservation. OSSA would be supportive of legislation changes addressing the issue of fresh pursuit to grant tribal police officers authority should the lower court decide that the decision of the lower court be upheld. We do firmly believe that an officer in a uniform, regardless of the badge or the color of the uniform, when tribal police have lawful authority to pursue a person and that pursuit crosses a jurisdictional boundary, the bad guy doesn't really care, and I think that the officer should be protected. That issue is not a concern for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. While having been actively involved in pre-hearing meetings on Senate Bill 412 prior to today's hearing, there is a clear message from the Indian tribal government. They want to possess enforcement authority off the reservation without any granting of reciprocity to the Oregon peace officers to enforce Oregon law upon tribal members on a reservation. And that's really where the big issue is coming from this, is tribal police, with the passage of Senate Bill 412 as written, would grant tribal police more authority than any other peace officer in the state of Oregon, because they can enforce state law on the reservation against all members, all citizens, while other police officers, state, county, and city, cannot come onto the reservation and enforce laws against tribal members. I would like to express my appreciation to the committee chair for his efforts in holding the pre-hearing meetings on Senate Bill 412. All parties involved in those meetings had very open and informative discussions on this bill regarding the issue of public safety both on and off the reservation. We all certainly agree there needs to be an addressing of the issue of fresh pursuit. However, beyond the issue, we're unable to come to any agreements regarding reciprocity and all law enforcement having the same police authority. In closing, the sheriffs of Oregon fully respect and support the rights of the tribes to self-govern on their land and govern their people on their land. Currently, under Oregon law, a sheriff may grant deputy status to a tribal police officer off the reservation, giving authority to assist local law enforcement. With the exception of the Kurtz case, tribal police have police powers they need to self-govern, and I respectfully request the committee to await the outcome of the Kurtz case, then, if needed, enact legislation granting fresh pursuit authority to tribal police officers. That's all I have this morning for the committee.
Thank you.
John? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. I represent the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and I couldn't have said it more succinctly or better than Sheriff Wolf. So in the deference to your time issue, I'll let Mr. Dleshman.
Thank you very much, Brian.
For the record, Brian Dleshman, I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations as well as the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the troopers. I would go down the same path as John Powell. It's not very often that the three of us sit at the table together and all agree, but the issue for us, both for the OCPA and the OSPOA, is the reciprocity issue. I've had officers, both state and local, indicate to me that they've had a hard time when they attempt to serve a warrant or do a pursuit, a subpoena, or issue a citation on tribal lands, in which they're told you'll just have to catch him when he's off tribal lands. And that doesn't seem fair, in which we're expanding the authority for tribal officers to enforce statutes off the tribal lands and not having the same issue go the other way. So our issue is reciprocity. It's the red dot on the end.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you all very much. I have two other people that are signed up, Kevin Campbell and Eric Gafflett. Why don't y'all two go ahead and come on up? This is going to conclude our testimony unless there's someone else that did not sign up for 412.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, Kevin Campbell again for the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I did want to mention briefly, I'm glad to have my son with me today, Chase. He has been sitting through this whole discussion.
Can we have Chase come on up?
Chase, will you come up?
Come on.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm always glad to have Chase with me. It's a great privilege. Thanks, buddy, for being here with me. Today, a few comments regarding this bill. First of all, this is a discussion that's been going on for a decade, probably, but the importance of the discussion has been increased with the Kurtz decision. I agree with Sheriff Wolf that the discussions have been vigorous and helpful, and I do believe that a number of concerns that the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police have had over the years with regard to training, with regard to insurance, regarding the tort liability issues have been, I believe, successfully addressed in this measure. I'm a little bit you know, this is unhelpful to say that I have friends that are opposing this bill that I work closely with on a number of issues, and I have friends in this bill that support the bill that are actually my members, and I'd like to say that I'm with my friends. It's a difficult issue, but for our association, I think there's a strong desire, if at all possible, to resolve the issue. Frankly, I prefer not to go through another work group process in future years, but I know there are still issues to address, but I thank the committee for addressing it. I think it's important, and I do think there is a court case that demands some action if possible.
Well, thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Eric. Thank you. Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Eric Gablix. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more often known as DPSST. We did have concerns with the original version of Senate Bill 412. We appreciate the chair and the work group that we were part of. Based on that, our concerns have been addressed. We have no issues with dash 1, dash 3, dash 4, dash 5, or dash 6. We're fine across the board there. If this bill is approved, what it would mean is that police officers and the police departments of the tribes would be under the same standards for DPSST as city, county, and state agencies. The one thing that it would require us to do is to compile and maintain insurance for the tribal police departments. That's not something we do for other agencies, but we feel it's essential for this bill to be successful, and we're glad to do that. So I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Chase, why don't you tell us, give us your name for the record, and tell us where you go to school.
My name's Chase, and I go to Willamette Valley Christian School.
All right, and are you here today because you're spring break?
Yeah.
Have you been able to help Dad so far?
I think.
Yeah, well, I think you have. You're right there on his right side. You're doing good.
I think he would make a far better lobbyist than me, and so I'm ready to turn over the reins. In fact, I have been for the last month, and he's just not, he's too smart to do it.
All right, well, that sounds great. Chase, thank you for being here, and gentlemen, thank you all for coming forward.
Thank you
again,
very much.
I'm going to ask you, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on the 412? Not seeing anyone come forward, I'm going to close the...
Can I ask a question of counsel real quick? Does anybody know where the Kurtz case is in the appeals process?
Court of Appeals.
Right, and it's been appealed to the Kurtz Supreme Court?
I can find out with certainty and follow up.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Let's see, Pete, real quick, you can put that on the record for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pete Shepard again. The Kurtz case was, of course, decided by the Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court argument the case has been briefed and orally argued, and it's pending decision from the Supreme Court.
All right. Thank you, Pete. I'm going to go ahead and close that public hearing on Senate Bill 412. And again, as I mentioned earlier, Senate Bill 421, Senate Bill 731, Senate Bill 740, Senate Bill 774 that were scheduled for public hearing and possible work session, they are carried over until this coming Monday, as well as for the work sessions that were scheduled for Senate Bill 347, 385, and 387. With that, we're adjourned, and I believe we're scheduled to be here at 8:30 on Monday. Thank you very much.